Thanks, David. This is an honor. It's not an honor that I accepted without trepidation, no. And it's an honor that I guess was offered once before, and I didn't feel I was quite ready, but hopefully, with my higher power working, I'm up to this. My wife told me to smile. She also told me to speak slowly. So I'll try to do those things. And since we only have 7 more minutes before the half hour is up, and Debbie's going to follow, and I've always feel comfortable when an Al-Anon is behind me picking up the pieces. You know, it's, by the grace of God and the fellowship of AA, I haven't had to take a drink since March 13th, 1989. However, I marked my recovery beginning about 2004. And you might get that understanding as I go along in my experience, strength, and hope. I'm married. I've been married for 45 years to the same woman. 2 years off for bad behavior. We have one child who's in and out of the program. My dad was in the Oxford movement. My sister is in AA. I have two uncles that should have been in AA. One died from cirrhosis of the liver. So the disease is in my family, and it's been there for generations. The symptoms for me showed up long before alcohol. Like the gal who wrote Freedom from Bondage, when I was a little boy, my behavior wasn't the standard that you would have your daughter or son play with this little boy. I was looking for something, and I didn't know what it was. Boy, you're way back there, Grizz. Can you hear me? Good. As a small child, I guess it started maybe when I was about 5 years old. I was having problems with at school, and I was doing things that the teachers didn't appreciate. A little bit later on, maybe 7 or 8, I started skiing so fast and so recklessly down the mountain, trying to impress these people, trying to get some acknowledgement of who I was, and really trying to fill that void that I had. I didn't know what I was doing, but you know, I knew that when people came up to me and said, "You've got the potential to be an Olympic skier," or whatever, you know, that kind of momentarily made me feel included, made me feel connected to something. I also did a few other things. I'd walk along the edges of the buildings in our little village, trying to be known as the daredevil. I climbed trees, and my mom would have to call the fire department to get me down. I did fall off that four-story building, the roof of a four-story building once. And no, I survived, slight concussion, but the great part, I thought, was I got my picture in the paper. And my uncle came home from World War II, and he had a lot of patches from his uniforms and some medals and stuff. And he gave them all to me, and I had my mom sew them on my little windbreaker. And I had these patches up and down this gray windbreaker. And I'd go to school, and I'd pick the biggest kid I could find and just try to beat him up. You know, more often than not, I was not successful. But the point was that I had bloodstains on this little jacket, and I wouldn't let my mom wash the jacket. You know, that was my badge. I've got courage. Little did they know I was such a frightened little boy inside, and I was really trying to feel loved and included and feel okay. And you know, that behavior kept on, and it showed up off and on as my life went on. But by the seventh grade, my parents thought I should be in military school, so off I went to military school. And between the eighth and ninth grade in military school, one of the cadets that I'd become friends with, his dad was in the customs service between U.S. and Canada, and he'd become friendly with this fellow who owned the Canada steamship line. So we signed on this other cadet and I in our summer break between the 8th and 9th grade to this freighter. It was a Canada Steamship Line freighter. I think it was about 600 feet long. We got on in Oswego, New York, and went out the Gulf of the St. Lawrence and up the Saguenay River and ended up in Bucktouche, New Brunswick. Everybody got paid just before we unloaded, or just after we had unloaded our cargo. And we were going to unload or load cargo, I think, at another port. Well, everybody got off except for a few people that stayed on the ship, and I was one of the ones that got off. And I don't know what happened to my cadet friend, Bobby Graham, but this sailor and I went to the drugstore, and we're sitting in the drugstore at the stools. And this is a real small French town, and this ship kind of overwhelmed the whole wharf at this town. And the druggist said, "Why don't you guys step in the back room?" Okay. Well, we went into the back room, and he immediately put down two big bottles of Old Moosehead Ale in front of us. So the night went on, and that was my first blackout. It was a blackout that really didn't alarm me too much. I kind of laughed at it and so on. And these blackouts would continue periodically up until 1989 when I stopped drinking. I did oftentimes use alcohol. I would, don't look so sad, Pam, please. I would use alcohol to sleep sometimes. On a Saturday, I'd get up early and I'd run and come home. I wouldn't have any breakfast, and I'd come home and mow the lawn, clean the pool, and ask Pam to make a salad and a couple glasses of wine, and then I was able to take a nap and, you know, get a little bit of break from the committee is going on in my head, the fear that was raging, the torment of the disease. And I carried that torment for a long time. And in 1989, I finally, the anxiety and the torment got too much for me. My wife wanted me to leave. She was avoiding me. I think our son had built himself a bedroom. We had built a house, and up above the garage there was a lot of space, and he built himself a bedroom up there to get away from me. My employees started to, you know, really revolt at this dictatorial boss they had, who they could never anticipate what he wanted, and he certainly didn't appreciate what they did. So, you know, I was feeling that things were coming to a head. So I went to Dallas, and I had been working for American Airlines. I went up to Dallas and talked to an employee assistance coordinator and said to her, "I think I have manic depression. I'm having a real problem here." She said, "Oh yeah, you might. But take this little questionnaire." So I took the questionnaire, and she came back and she said, "You might have manic depression, but you also might have a problem with alcoholism. And we have contracted with this rehab facility here in Dallas for the management people, and I can get you into that facility probably next week." I said, "Oh no, I'm not ready to go. I just came up here really in the back of my mind to kind of save my job until I could find some other situation to get into. But I said, I will go. I want to get my son situated at the University of Colorado in Boulder," and so on and so forth. I was talking to her in June. I had stopped drinking at March 13th, 1989, because of all this torment, and I had started a Course in Miracles, or done a Course in Miracles. We did a marriage encounter. I did a physical fitness program. We did Hidden Keys to Successful Relationships programs. You know, I was looking, and we sought psychological help. You know, I was looking everywhere. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I'm looking at all these other things. And to make a long story short, I ended up going to the rehab. I checked in August, and I think Pam and our son went to Europe, and I think just before she left, she said, "When you're through, don't plan on coming home." This was part of my 2 years off for bad behavior. But I went to the rehab, and about the third week, I guess she hadn't gone to Europe yet. The third week, they called her to come up, and they called my boss to to come in, and they did what they called a staffing. And I wasn't there, but this is what was told to me. They said to my boss and my wife, Mr. Smith is very, very sick. He's very alcoholic, and we're not having very much success in treating him. Now, my boss is a wonderful guy, and American Airlines is a self-insured organization, and this is coming out of his budget, you know, and his income is somewhat connected to how he performs with his budget, but he was a very gracious man. And they said, we would like to recycle Chip in this program. We think that we have some other methods that we can use that might be helpful to him, if he's agreeable. And I don't know how I got the word. I think I got the word from Pam or my boss that they wanted to do this. They claimed that I was manipulating the counselors and that I was taking control of the meetings in there. And, you know, all I remember is that I convinced them that I could go out every day and ride my bike, and they agreed if I would do a urinalysis every day, something to do with their liability, I guess. But that's the only thing I thought that I, you know, was doing differently. But all the time, you know, I'm walking around reading the book, and I've got the book on tape, and I'm really trying to get this program, and, you know, I think I'm getting it, and, you know, I could regurgitate a lot of the stuff that I read, and I was still doing a lot of physical fitness stuff. So I was kind of disappointed when I got the news that I wasn't doing well. And but you know, my emotions go like this, and I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do another 4.5 weeks or whatever it was, and I'll agree to whatever treatment they can do." They took me back to my room, and about an hour later, one of the counselors showed up, and he said, "We're going to blindfold you in about an hour, just before lunch, and we're going to keep the blindfolds on 24 hours a day for a number of days." I said, "No problem." So he left. I immediately went into the bathroom, and I set out all my toilet articles. I took a walk to the cafeteria trying to memorize the route down there, you know, with my hand on the wall and the layout, you know, and everything. And I thought, I got these guys. So we went to lunch, and I made it through lunch. I was pretty proud of myself. I had enough to eat and came back to the room. And again, the counselor showed up, and he said, "Well, Chip," he said, "you know, we're going to go bowling this afternoon." Oh, I said, "Oh, man. How am I going to bowl?" He said, "Well, we'll work it out." And they came back a half hour, and he said, "We're ready to go. The bus is out here, and we're all going bowling." Our little group of like 12 AA people in this facility. And this is John. You remember John from the meetings? Oh, yeah, I remember John. John didn't say much, and he was a big guy, and he's really kind of quiet and didn't participate in the meetings in the rehab. And shook John's hand and said, "Okay, well, let's go." So we get in the bowling alley, you know, and I'm trying to listen to everything that's going on. All the pins crashing over here, and I'm trying to find out where the soda fountains are and stuff like that. I'm trying to imagine that I can't see anything. And said, "It's your turn." I've never bowled very much, you know. But they got the ball in my hand, and I said, "Okay," and I, you know, wound up, and I threw it, and I thought it was aimed pretty much for the alley, but I heard the clunk, you know, as it went in the gutter. I did that a couple times, and then I said, "John," I said, what's your part in this deal?" He said, "I'm going to help you." I said, "Well, that's good. Aim me towards the alley." So we got lined up, everything, and we did okay, and I learned later that afternoon that John really had difficulty in giving help and assistance. I didn't put together the fact that I had a problem asking for help, you know. But anyway, there were a few, you know, a few other things that they did, and they let me get out after I think about 8.5 weeks, and I went up to Jackson Hole, and I called my boss, and he said, "Well," he said, you can come back to work." He said, "I've got a position for you in Tulsa," and my salary had continued all this time, you know. So we're talking a couple months now, and I said, Bill, really, I don't want any employees, and I'm really, you know, I had problems before, and I really just don't know what I want to do, but I'd like to go back, you know, up to Jackson Hole, and I feel kind of a spiritual connection with the mountains. He said, that's fine. He said, no problem. He said, call me when you think you're ready to come back to work. So I went up to Jackson Hole, and I went to AA meetings every day. And I worked out. I was staying at the Racquet Club, and it was a health club right there. I worked out, and I went to meetings, and I went to Exum Climbing School, and climbed this mountain, this Grand Teton, and almost died and made a foxhole commitment to my higher power doing that. But he called me, and he said, I've got a position for you in Gunnison. He said, we only have really two cities in the kind of area that you're talking about, Steamboat and Gunnison. I said, Gunnison's great. That's kind of a low-key operation. So that's how I got to Colorado. And I came here in the fall of 89 and started going to meetings in Gunnison, and then I ended up coming up here. I was, you know, doing the reading the big book and the 12 and 12 and working through the steps, and came up here with John D. Some people probably remember John Demel, rest his soul. And we did a fourth and fifth step. You know, I'm separated from my wife at this time, so I'm just up here working on my program and really had everything going for it. And I did that. I kept coming up here, and I kept going to meetings in Gunnison, and reading the big book, and went on for 15 years like that. Today, my sister says, you know, you suffered from being stark raving sober for 15 years, and I was stark raving sober. You know, some of you people that have seen me hike and do outlandish things, like try to carry a 48-pound crystal back on my pack and off a mountain, and, you know, just, you know, really ridiculous stuff. But it went on, and we bought a house. We'd spent 4 winters in New Zealand because New Zealand was a great place. You know, if an alcoholic wants a place where there's very little confrontation and very little problems, there's no traffic problems, there's no security problems, everybody's polite. I mean, it's a place to escape to. Not a place to grow from, but to escape to. So we'd spent 4 winters down there, and it got to a point where we had to go to Florida because our moms were down there. So my home group, and I have a home group and a sponsor, and I sponsor other alcoholics. My home group is the Shore Acres Gratitude Group in St. Pete, Florida. However, I spend 5.5 months here, and I go to the last resort as frequently as I can. And I've actually started out in the last resort pretty much, except for the time in Jackson Hole. So 15 years of being stark raving sober, and we bought a house in Florida, and our son was up in Sun Valley, and he was building houses, and I asked him if he'd come down for a few weeks because we just bought this house and help us put in some floors and things like that. So he flew down. It was at Christmas time, I think. Yeah, it was at Christmas time, about 2004, and I met him at the airplane, and he's got all these tools and baggage and all this stuff. So we came back to the house, and we started working, and he and I, and, you know, here's the old obsessive compulsive stuff going on in my head. Well, we need to get this done. We need to get that done. And after, and he was going to stay, I think, for 3 weeks. And after 5 or 6 days, he said, Dad, I'm going back. And I said, JT, I said, why? He said, you're a dry drunk, and I can't stand being around you. That, and it makes me shiver now. That was the emotional bottom, and that was when I became teachable. So what I did differently is I started... It's in the flowers. He's buried and he has flowers. Yeah. So JT left, you know. You know, and like most alcoholics, you know, I wanted everything for my son. We only wanted one child because I didn't want him to turn out like I did. I didn't want to have him suffer from the torment of this disease, you know, treated or untreated alcoholism, the torment. I knew the pain, and I didn't want him to have it. But, you know, here he is saying, "Dad, I can't stand you." So he went away, and I went to AA. And I went to a meeting, and a gal was there speaking. And she was very candid. She had had a terminal disease, and she shared, you know, to very, very candidly everything about her experience, strength, and hope. So I went to her, and I asked her after the meeting, I said, "Would you help me get a sponsor?" Because I didn't really know anything about getting a sponsor, but at that point I was willing, and I'd heard a lot about sponsorship, you know. But I'd been here for 15 years, and I hadn't drunk, and I, you know, but I really finally realized I couldn't do it by myself. So I got a wonderful sponsor, and we started in the very beginning, and, you know, we did what I call the Jackson Five. He said, you know, 90 meetings, 90 days, but every day, on your knees in the morning, read the big book, go to a meeting, talk to another alcoholic, and thank God at night. And, you know, I did that every day for more than 90 days, and things began to start happening. The pressure started to come off. You know, my perception about things changed. I wasn't quite so violent in traffic. You know, my relationships started to get better. I could begin to communicate honestly with these guys and women in AA, and things at home started to improve. And I started to develop a relationship with my higher power based upon the principles behind the steps. I didn't even know what the principles behind the steps were for the first 15 years. Today I carry and I share a list of those principles, and I try to apply these principles to my actions every day, my interactions. Sometimes I do good and sometimes I don't. And to me that developed maybe it was a little character building, but it was a relationship with my higher power, you know. And that relationship filled that void. It took away that fear that I had inside me ever since I was a little boy, and things began to settle down. I'm sure my blood pressure went down and everything else, and it was just a wonderful resource. And my hope today is that I can continue along this spiritual path, this relationship, and that I may be of some service as my higher power sees fit. And, you know, I'll continue, I'm committed to continue to try as best I can to live by those principles, you know, and to bring along other alcoholics. I had two very different experiences this year. I had a wonderful young guy who was a physicist. He was teaching at Western, and he started out, and he just flew. And I thought, well, I'm going to have a problem with this guy. You know, he's a typical scientist, you know, and you know, the spiritual thing. But it didn't work out at all. I mean, that way, he just flew. And then I had another guy who committed suicide. In about March, he had a real problem with this powerlessness concept. He'd been very successful, and it didn't work. I mean, we did the best we could, and I accept that as, you know, God's will. But you know, I'm going to try to carry the flag and continue to carry flag, and to accept the challenges. You know, I feel there are lots of obligations I have to meet. You know, and by the grace of God, I'll be able to continue to do that. And thank you very much for letting me share.